My name's Shelby, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Mark. I know he's not here tonight, but for asking me to speak last minute. It's crazy how God works when you least expect it, right? And I truly appreciate him reaching out and God using him that day when he reached out. And thank you, Chris, for being my dessert buddy and coming through. Like always, I so appreciate you being the 10-minute speaker. You killed it. My sobriety date's August 22nd of 2015, and for that, I'm forever grateful. I have a sponsor. She knows she's my sponsor. She's been my sponsor my whole sobriety. And I have a home group. And those are three things. Chris talked about it, and I'm going to talk about it. They're crucial for my sobriety. You know, I really don't want to do this. I kind of want to throw up, so I'm just going to say it now, and then it's going to go. I've done this before, and it doesn't matter. So I'm going to share with you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I'm not originally from Lancaster, as most of you guys know. I was born in Oceanside, California, on Camp Pendleton, at a naval base and a naval hospital. And life was good growing up in San Diego County, not gonna lie. You know, being right by the beach all the time. You know, I was with my single mother, an older brother, and it was pretty good, but it was really uncomfortable from the jump, from when I can remember. You know, my dad's one of us, and I didn't know that until later on in life. So I grew up in San Diego County. I always felt weird because I'm a ginger and we had no souls. So that never helped, you know. I always felt like I just didn't belong growing up at all. I felt the, like, just awkward. The red hair didn't help. I was, like, pasty. You know, my dad was gone. I just didn't fit in, right? But on the inside, I just didn't like myself. I had the external love growing up in the family, but I did not have the internal love. I didn't believe anything anybody was telling me. And I had unconditional love, you know? Because my dad was not with us, I had an aunt, and my grandparents helped raise me and my brother with my mom. And they would try to give us so much love, and I still didn't believe it. So, you know, growing up, it was awkward. And so I wanted to be the cool kid. I always wanted to be the Pink Ranger, not the Yellow Ranger. I wanted to be, you know, like, and I never got to be because the other girls were blondes and this and that. And I'm like, how am I going to be cool, you know? So fast forward, you know, my mom always said, don't turn out like your dad. 8 years old, she throws me in a mental institution. And she says, I'm just like my dad. This is where I know by working the steps that I'm a master manipulator long before I take a drink. I was just seeking attention and love, and I was always acting out because I just wanted to belong, and I just wanted my mom to see me and my stepdad. And so she threw me in a mental institution, and I'm like, fuck, I don't belong here. You know, like, these people are actually crazy. I really don't belong here. Kind of like when I got to you guys, I'm like, I don't think I belong here. But I do belong here with you guys. So I had to really work my way out of that mental institution at the age of 8. They said I had to throw, you know, show anger, show emotion. And all I was sad. I wasn't like the other kids, you know? And so that was my first time that I can fully remember manipulating a situation so I could get the hell out of there. You know, I just wanted to be home with my brother and my mom. There was a lot of abuse. There was a lot of, you know, mental, emotional, and physical abuse. None of that makes me an alcoholic. But it did help fuel my need to drink because I love being the victim. So, you know, fast forward, I didn't have my first drink until I was in middle school with my brother. It was Jack Daniel's Punch in the 4-pack. I don't know if anybody remembers those, but it was a house party. My mom was working nights, and it was in that little bottle, and I'll never forget it. And it was so good. I took that first drink. I was like, ooh, this is tasty. You know, I could do this. I drank all four, and I was a blackout drinker from the jump. That's what I was. I don't remember much besides drinking all of that, and people asking if my brother was my younger brother. And I was like, I'm winning. I'm winning in life. People think I'm the older sister. Finally, I'm not Steve's little sister. And because I always wanted to be something I wasn't. I couldn't just be Shelby because I didn't know who Shelby was, right? And so that was my first drunk. It was fun. It was blackout. Woke up the next morning, no hangover or anything like that. I just was like, eh. But I could do this again, you know? But being in middle school, I was pretty young, so we couldn't get the alcohol like that. But my brother did have the parties. And my mom always said growing up, you know, Shelby, alcoholism runs on both sides of the family. You need to be really careful. But, you know, just make sure, you know, it's a red flag if you're wanting to do it by yourself. But if you're socializing and, like, social drinking, it probably isn't a red flag. You'll be okay. So I ran with that. If you're a true alcoholic like me, I will manipulate that statement like no other because, well, I'm being social. I don't want the drink. I'm just going to party with some people, you know, not knowing I needed the drink. You know, I had no idea I needed it to live life. I don't know how to live life sober. And so it didn't progress. I wasn't an everyday drinker. You know, my mom moved me out of California because my mom loves geographics too. And she moves me to Coos Bay, Oregon, this small little redneck town. And I'm like, oh God, I have to reinvent myself. You know, it's a small little redneck town. I'm like, all I know about Oregon is it's the Oregon Trail. Will they have makeup? Like, I don't even know. Just, you know, I was a teenager about to start high school. And, like, I was supposed to go to the high school there in San Diego. And she's uprooting me one more time, you know. And I'm like, what am I going to do, man? And so this is my time to make a name for myself. And I'm not Steve's little sister. I get to be what I want to be. And my mom's like, you're going to do marching band. And I'm like, absolutely not. Have you seen those uniforms? I will not be cool here. You know, I am just so shallow, right? Because I just need to fit in wherever I belong. And that's not fitting in with the marching band. It was pirates, so absolutely not. And it wasn't cute. It really wasn't. Looking back, I'm like, wow, I saved myself. That was God doing for me. So instead, I got into radio. I was the DJ for the high school radio because we had that there. And, you know, I remember in high school, you know, watching the kids, it was like either fishing or hunting. You know, those are the two priorities up there in that small little redneck town. A lot of Carhartt butts, Romeos, you know, and a lot of dipping, you know, and a lot of dunes. So we were either mudding or at the dunes, one of the two. And so I was going to hang out with the cool kids. So I started finding my way. People thought I was a cop because I had a pager. They were like, are you sure you're not a cop? Because, you know, I had a pager. And I'm like, and I was also may or may not have been stealing my mom's Vicodins because I needed to make an income because I was working at the commissary when I was younger in middle school and I had money coming in, but my mom wasn't giving me an allowance up there. So I'm going to find a way to make some money. And so I'm going to steal my mom's pills. You know, that's the only thing that comes to mind. Not get a job or anything like that. I'm too young. So let me do that. I'm like, I swear, I'm not a cop. They're like, if you say it three times, that means you're not a cop. I was like, I'm not a cop. I really thought that was true for the longest amount of time. Come to find out that is not true. They can still be a cop and say it three times that they're not. And so, just saying. So, you know, I got to hang out with the jocks. I got to hang out with the cool kids and the older kids because that's where I fit in, you know. I'm going to be all over the place because that's just kind of where my head is because I'm not so spiritually fit today. I'm doing my best that I can, but this is the perfect place where I need to be. I found camaraderie in drinking. I really did. When I was working on that military base at the commissary, my cousin worked there. My uncle was the one that gave me a job. I was a bagger. And back in the day, I don't know if anybody's prior military or former military. Thank you for your service if you are. But, you know, it's cash only. It's under the table. So all baggers make tips. And back then, we made some money. So as a 12, 13-year-old working, I was making about $200 a day. So $400 in 2 days, right? What am I going to do with that? I'm going to have my brother take some of my money so that I can party, right? But also I'm going to have my cousin call the payphone in the office and tell me, hey, Shell, we have some 40s out here. Why don't you come out? And that's where I found my people. Didn't matter the ethnicity. I came out there. We were all drinking 40s. It didn't matter if you're Puerto Rican, Filipino. It didn't matter. We all got along, and we all had that camaraderie, and it was the alcohol that brought us together and the partying, right? And I loved it, and I never wanted to lose that. And I felt cool, you know, I felt accepted, I felt seen, and like I could breathe, you know, I could just be me. And so I did that in Oregon, and let me tell you, I didn't think I had a problem then either, you know. My mom, this is the cool part, in high school my mom said, you know, we're going to make some Blackberry Everclear. It was illegal to get Everclear down in California at the time. I don't know if it is still. So Oregon, you could buy Everclear. It's 100 proof. And we'd pick blackberries because we lived upriver. And Mrs. Smith gave us this recipe. And she said, oh, yeah, my grandkids pour it over their Tillamook ice cream. Like, it's great, you know. And so we were making this. And one morning, I remember this very vividly. She's like, hey, Shell, it's ready. Come take a shot. My mom is not about the drinking, right? And I'm like, sweet, it is the crack of noon on a Saturday. I'm getting to drink some liquor. This is amazing. And it was so good. The burn was a burn. And it was just delicious. And I'm like, I love the way I feel by this one little shot. I need to have more. So I would steal all the mason jars that she was prepping for Christmas gifts and bring them to the parties. Because, you know, I don't think about anybody else but myself. I just need to be the cool person. I need to have that escape. So... you know, it went on. I barely graduated high school. I, you know, barely made it out of Oregon. But I said, you know, I can't live like this up here because there's nothing for me. I was always pointing the finger at my mom and everybody else. Like, I couldn't keep friends. I couldn't keep anything. You know what I mean? And I was just miserable. But it was my mom's fault. If you live the life I live, it was their fault. My dad's absent, whatever the case may be, right? And, so I decided I want to move back to California after high school. And so I come live with my grandparents, and I come to what I know, which is the military base. And I get a job with the DOD at the age of 18. And looking back, I had it really good. I had it really, really good. Because everybody knew me. I was KT's niece. Like, they'd seen me literally from the womb and grow up. And so I was doing the deal. I had a really good thing going. And, you know, alcoholism and drug addiction really, they kill. They kill. You know, that cousin that used to call me in the payphone, I was partying with him. He showed me a new way of life after I got out of high school. You know, you could slip a couple things over the counter and get, like, two 24-packs for free. And I'm like, I like that kind of lifestyle. I want to do that when I grow up. And so we were hanging out a lot, and he decided he needed to go to rehab finally. And what had happened was that he had his last hurrah, but he, like so many of us, didn't get to make it to rehab. He died in a hotel room from alcoholism and drug addiction. And that man, I love my big brother, but he was more of a big brother to me. And he died, and I saw him being taken out in a body bag. And that's, I believe, where I crossed the invisible line, because I don't know how to live life sober. I don't have a God of my own understanding. I don't know how to feel feeling sober. I need something to numb this. And so I remember that night my brother got me a handle of Captain Morgan's and a little bit of marijuana where you had to pick the seeds out. And because we don't have that freaking, like, government grade stuff back then, like stuff the kids are doing now. I'm like, good God. It's like ketamine or something. It'll knock you down. I'm like, good Jesus. But wild. But the only thing that soothed me, everybody was saying, I'm sorry, you know. And nothing worked besides Captain Morgan's that night, you know. And I found my solution. I really found my solution because I couldn't not do it. So that job with the DOD, I was showing up still drunk the next morning. I was driving on base under the influence. How I got away with that and didn't get a DUI, I don't know. I would flirt, but that would only get people so far. You know what I mean? And then I couldn't live at my grandparents' house because I just couldn't be there. Because my grandparents, God bless them, they not only raised my aunts and my mom, but they also raised my brother and myself and always made sure we had a home to go to no matter what. And so they had a duplex, and my aunt was like, here, just stay here because I know you're going through it really bad. And so there was a bunch of liquor in the cabinet, and this is the duplex I grew up in when my first couple years, and there was a bunch of liquor, and I don't know how to be by myself with myself either. I don't know if anybody can relate to that, but I need to have people around me. And so what better way is to have a party? A party that goes on for months and months and months, right? And we start playing with outside issues because I'm having nightmares every night. The liquor isn't just doing it anymore. So, you know, I just need to roll with the homies. And we have parties, like, every single night. Things get broken. I don't care about my grandparents' stuff because it's all about me, and don't you know I'm grieving. And so I lose that job with the DOD. And so I'm like, okay, well, it's their fault. I'm part of a union. Like, I had nothing to do with it. My till was not short. They switched my till. I still don't know if that's true to this day because I was really drunk all the time. So I lost that job. And so I'm like, okay, well, something's got to change. You know, I got to do something. So I get another job, not on the military base. And I feel like, you know, a hymn will fix things. And I always said when I was growing up, I will never get with a Marine. I will never get with a first responder. I will never do any of that. So what better way to fix my life is get with a Marine. And I take my first official hostage, you know, and because I'm skipping some stuff. You guys don't need to hear about it. There was a dude, a drug dealer, you know, all those things. But, you know, because we could really bring those home to Grandma and Grandpa on Sunday night dinners. I live a double life. Right? I live a double life no matter what, ever since I was younger. And, you know, the Sunday night dinners with Grandma and Grandpa, prim and proper, using our manners, all the things. And then I leave and I'm off and popping and bandana in my hair. Some of you guys saw me when I first came in with the bandana, cut off shirt. I would just like, you know, cider. And that literally, that's what I would wear, you know, even when I first got sober. I mean, that's all I had. But, and so, you know, I find a hymn, and he's a Marine, and I'm like, okay, we're going to have the white picket fence. I'm going to get my stuff together. I don't have a problem. I just need a guy. I need my Prince Charming, right? So we'll have the white picket fence, the dogs, the family, all the things. And so we move in together within 30 days, typical, right? And then within 6 months, we're married. And he's deploying to Afghanistan. But in those 6 months, I'm telling him he has a drinking problem. You might want to slow down, right? But don't you know I'm in recovery, not knowing what recovery even was. I had no idea. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm sober. Well, I'm going to the bar on Thirsty Thursdays for football, you know? And so it's just, I was selfish, self-seeking from the jump, you know? I was so inconsiderate and not thinking about anybody else but myself because I wanted to feel good about myself. And so... we get married, he deploys, and I'm going to get my act straight. I'm just going to stick to liquor because I love my outside issues. I love my party favors, but, you know, I'm not going to jeopardize his career, and I'm going to do something with my life. And that lasts until about the invasion of Marja, and that war was pretty bad. And the rule is if you're a military wife, you don't ring the doorbell. Right when that significant other is deployed, because that usually means somebody's coming up in their dress blues and to tell you some bad news. And so somebody rang my doorbell and I lost it. It wasn't somebody in their dress blues, it was just somebody that didn't know. And so I was like, I need something to fix this because I can't deal. I just can't deal with life right now. And so I called my friends over to the apartment, and once again, here I go, the ball rolling again. And I never thought I had a problem. You guys, I never thought it was alcoholism that I was suffering from, ever. I thought it was my family. I thought it was I was married to a Marine, so I just need to fix that. You know, I'm just not loved. I all the things, right? The list can go on. But so fast forward, we're together for a long time. And my alcoholism just keeps progressing and progressing and progressing. And we do some geographics because he gets out of the military. We go to Texas. And, you know, God bless this man. I don't like him. I came to find out I never even liked this man that I married. You might want to find that out. Just a little pointer. You might want to like your significant other before you marry him. That's been my experience. I loved the guy, but I didn't like him. And, I didn't like anything he did. He made me cringe. You know what I mean? But I was going to do anything I could to keep my habit going and my alcoholism going. And that image, because I'm all about image. I'm not about looking at me. So we do some geographics, and I'm like, I just can't do this. So instead, I, you know, get a boyfriend while being married, you know, because that'll fix it, because you're just not hitting the needs, while living a double life. And so where my alcoholism takes me is where it puts him living in the shop that he's working out of, you know, sleeping on an air mattress in the back of a shop. I'm living my best life, you know, running amok in the streets because I'm not affecting anybody but myself, right? All I think about is me. And my my alcoholism took me to that, to where we were putting hands on each other, living in and out of hotel rooms, you know, and to where I just didn't care, and I didn't hide my drinking or anything else from him, because I couldn't keep the funk anymore. Like, I just couldn't keep that act up anymore. My family had disowned me. I remember Christmas of 2014, he calls my brother up, and he's like, you need to get your sister. And I'll never forget this day. My brother comes on base, and he's like, where's my sister? I just want my little sister back. And I said, I'm right here. All I could think about was the drink in the bathroom, you know? Not knowing that my big brother, who, you know, we've both been through it, but he's just wanting his sister back, and I can't see that I'm not there, you know? So I'm right here. Michael's the problem, you know? And so it goes on for a little bit. He's about to have a baby that year in 2015, and I'm putting together this baby shower. And what happened was is I get disowned by my brother because of my alcoholism. He doesn't want me around, and I'm like, what the heck? He's the golden child in the family growing up, you know, because he's the only boy. And I'm thinking it's that, you know. And then my grandparents shut me out, and they're like, you're not welcome here. And I'm like, it's only because, you know, my brother, and da-da-da-da-da. Not knowing I'm gray tone skin. My eyes are like Puss in Boots. I am dying on the inside out, you know. I was dead spiritually. Next was physically, for sure, because I was drinking to die. And the only person in my family that did not give up on me and would meet me, you know, once a month whenever she came down from San Francisco was my aunt. And she'd make sure I was eating, even let me have a drink, because we weren't that kind of family. Like, you know, the appetizers and the drinks, it's always like water and, you know, no appetizers, just get the meal. And so she would make sure I had something to go home to and everything. That husband of mine, I kicked him out of the state. I said, you need to get out of the state before I kill you or have you killed, because that's kind of nice people I hang out with, right? I love those kind of people. And I love putting fear inside you, because I'm terrified. I can't let you know that I'm scared, so I'm going to make sure you're scared instead. And I'm a real stellar individual, right, when I'm drinking. And so he leaves the state, and I'm here with my dog, and we're living in and out of my car, getting hotel rooms, hanging out with stellar people. And one day I have a hotel room, and Poquito's on my lap, and, you know, that boyfriend of mine, because, you know, I got to have that side piece. He's like, you can only hang out with certain people. It's only safe that way. And I was like, okay. So I help out this dude, and I have local PD and sheriff's department busting in my hotel room door. And this is how I know God is real, because I should not have been able to walk away that day. And I had Poquito on my lap, my safe under Poquito, and I played the game. Oh, I'm a military wife. I don't know what you're talking about. My husband's going to kill me if he knows about this. Da, 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 da. Good mouthpiece back then. I can't lie for anything today. And so I remember that, and that was my, like, wake-up moment. Like, I need to just get away from these people. I need to live something different than this, because I can't keep doing this. I'm going to go to jail. I'm going to go to prison, or I'm going to get killed, because that's just what I do, and that's what happens with people I hang around. And so I call that husband of mine up, and I'm like, hey, I need help. I called this lady I know who had just taken 20 years, and I said, Miss Amy, I need your help. And she said, well, for one, why don't you stop hanging out with my son? And I said, well, he looks out for me. She's like, Shelby, just one day at a time. How about that? And say the serenity prayer. And I'm like, okay, I don't know how to do this, because I don't know how to do this on my own. And I tried for a couple weeks of, you know, trying to stay away from her son, try to stay away from people, places, and things, right? But I can always find our people wherever we go. And so then I'm at the end of it, and I am in my car with Poquito in the Valley of Oceanside, and I have a bottle, I have pills, I have everything under the sun, and I'm drinking and I'm popping everything I can, because I just don't want to live anymore, because my life is just so unmanageable, and nobody loves me, nobody cares about me, I don't even love me, and Poquito is my pride and joy. If you know me and you know my story, Poquito is my everything, and he was my ride or die, and I didn't care if I died that night and left him in the car, because I was that miserable, you know. And so I woke up the next morning, and fortunately, but I didn't think it was very fortunate that morning, and I said, damn it, God, why? Why? And so that husband of mine calls me, and he says, go to Megan's. She'll let you hang out there for a little bit till I get you into treatment. And that was August 22nd of 2015. And And it's funny because August 22nd of 2015 was also my brother's belly button birthday. And that was, there was no intention of trying to get sober on my brother's birthday. It's just kind of weird how it intertwines. And I started detoxing on my friend's couch and in her spare bedroom. And I did not have detox meds. I did not have any comfort meds. I didn't even know what detoxing was from alcohol and other issues. I just thought I needed a nap because I was up for a while. And I needed maybe like a sandwich. That's what I thought I needed. I did not know that you could die from detoxing from alcoholism. I had no freaking clue. The sweats, the chills. I think I had like two sips of water from what I remember. It was very just out of the world experience and out of body experience. And I couldn't even go smoke a cigarette. And I love my cigarettes. And I was detoxing and I was calling the lady for the rehab up here. And I'm like, if you don't get me in, I'm going to get loaded again. Like, I can't live like this. I was crawling out of my skin because I had been drinking and doing all other things for 10 plus years, just going strong, right? And so I detoxed and I got into a treatment center up here in Palmdale. When they said Palmdale, I was like, oh, I could do that. Because I had no idea what treatment was about. I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was about. I had no idea, except for I went to a meeting once looking like Puss in Boots. That's all I knew, you know? And so I was like, I could do Palmdale Afro Man, you know, I could smoke some pot when I get into here. Cause I just have like a slinging problem. I don't have a drinking problem. You know, I just need to be able to manage and control my own life. And so I get to this treatment center and, it's interesting because my dad, he's one of us and he was the only person willing to take me to treatment. And you know, we've had a really weird relationship my whole entire life. And he did for me what he couldn't do for himself, and that was him drive me up to Palmdale and check me into treatment. And for that, I'm forever grateful, you know, because he couldn't do that for me and my brother, but he did it for me. And that was huge, because that doesn't happen, you know? And so he drops me off, and I'm like, can I bring Poquito? And they're like, no. I'm like, okay, well, crap, what am I supposed to do? So my dad takes my dog, and I do treatment, and and I'm so grateful for being able to exit where I was because I couldn't get sober in San Diego. I knew too many people and I was doing really bad things. And so I need to get out and do one more geographic. And that owner of that treatment center, he gave me a book, Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And also like they want you to fill out an autobiography, like tell me about yourself. And I don't like following rules. So I'm like, I'm not filling out that. So I'm going to open this up. I got nothing else. Like, I can't have my phone. I can't make phone calls. I'm, you know, I think on a 2-week block where you can't do anything. And, so I open up that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and it opens up to the doctor's opinion. And I remember reading it in my room and I was so out of place, you guys, cause I'd been living on the streets for a good year and this was a mansion in Palmdale. And I'm like, I don't belong here. You know, like it's just really out of body experience. Like this is really uncomfortable. We have trust fund babies up in here and I'm straight off the streets, you know? And so I'm reading that book and I can relate. I can relate to the doctor's opinion and the alcoholism and the two parts of it. I didn't know, like I needed my sponsor to like break it down more, but I didn't know there was two parts. I didn't know I had an allergy of the body. I didn't know there was a mental obsession. I had no idea what alcoholism was. I just knew it ran in my family. That's all. Nobody explained it because nobody has ever worked the steps in my family. So obviously. And so I came in here blind and I don't like reading. Also, I hate reading. I always have, unless there's pictures, I'm all about it. And telling my own story, that's how I was, you know, and, I can have an imagination, but this, I didn't try. I just read it and, I was like, wow, okay, I'm here to do this thing. And my ex-husband, he was like, you know, you got to do this program for 6 months and I'll give you alimony. That's my deal. And I was like, oh, I could do 6 months. Not a problem. Didn't get the alimony. Definitely not. I think I got 1 month, but I got something way better than the alimony. I got out of that treatment center. There were some issues, people stealing money out of my wallet, almost getting kicked out, threatening to smother some women with pillows. Cause again, I told you guys, I like to put fear into people when I'm scared because I'm not going to show you who I truly am and what I'm really going through because I don't know how to live life sober. I don't know how my emotions are. I don't know how to maneuver anything sober. Right? So I'm just going to threaten to smother people with some pillows because don't steal money from me. And so that owner took me down to his other treatment center and I had an experience like no other. And And I stayed for a little bit, and you guys told me, I remember in the rooms, like, especially at Rafters, like, they're like, you know, talking about four step and this and that and the problem. And I'm like, well, I can't wait to get to the four step to see where I'm the problem. Cause I was only on step one and two in treatment. And the old timers were like, stick around and you'll find out, kid. And I'm like, challenge accepted. Let's go. You know, I will prove you wrong. Come to find out I'm the problem in everything. No matter where I go, I am the problem, right? Without a God of my own understanding. And without a solution. So I get out of treatment and I do what you guys tell me. I get a sponsor right away. And I had met her on an H&I panel. And I'm so grateful for H&I panels that come into treatment centers because they carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she carried the message. And she said the word God and I didn't cringe. You know, I did cross out God in my first big book. I was looking through it not that long ago, my first big book, and I was like, God, nope, we're going to do higher power. You know, because it made me cringe. Because if there was a God, he wouldn't have put me through this kind of life that I was living. But I had no idea that I set the ball rolling, you know. I set the ball rolling to my life. And so, you know, she took me through these steps, honestly, thoroughly. I did it with her. We did it swiftly because we don't believe in sitting on them. And I remember taking my third step with her at a Starbucks on I and 20th. She got me out of out of my sober living. And we got on our knees and we said the third step prayer. And it was sufficient enough for me. That feeling that I felt, not everybody has this feeling, but that feeling I felt when I turned my will and my life over to a God of my own understanding that day, I felt a release. Like when I first had my first drink of Jack Daniel's Punch, but better. It was like on steroids. I was like, oh my God. I'm really doing something here. And so then we got into my four step right away because it doesn't say to sit on it, right? Now we do this. I'm paraphrasing. And I'm like, ooh, I love playing victim because I'm forever the victim. So, and I had that challenge with those old timers at the Rafters. So I'm going to find out where I'm the problem, not thinking I am the problem. And I was going, no matter what it was, if I couldn't sleep at sober living, I was waking up in the middle of the night, I would go downstairs into the kitchen, I would bring my four step and I'd work on that thing. Because it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Thoroughly followed the path. And I didn't want to go back to that lifestyle. Because I got a little taste of sobriety and abstinence and like abstinence of what this life may be. I see all you guys and I see like how good your lives are. How can I get there? You know what I mean? And also the motivation of alimony, that helped too. But I'm financially driven, what can I say? And so I'm doing that four step and I'm feeling freer every resentment that I'm putting down, right? And every, you know, what was the cause? Why I was resentful and what it affected. I love the first three columns, you guys. The fourth column was a doozy. Fourth column was a doozy because we have to turn our thinking around and look at ourselves, right? And if you haven't been in a four-step, I hope you get to that point because that's where I got to have a little more freedom, right? And so we did the four-step, and then she spent 13 hours with me on a fifth step, not asking me for money, not asking me for anything. She even got me some Starbucks. We sat in the park at Raleigh-Dudley, and we just let it all out. And what I want to tell anybody that's new here, don't try to leave anything out when you're doing that fifth step because it talks about it in the big book, and I almost did. I was this close. We're on my way back to sober living. And I was like, oh, there's it's fine. She's like, no, Shelby, do you want to be free or do you want to be right? I want to be free. So I let it go. I wasn't going to tell this woman all my deepest, darkest secrets, but she had things for me, too, that she did that was just as bad or worse, right? I'm like, okay, I'm not so bad. And so we did that, and I took my hour. It was interrupted because sober living. But then I got to restart my hour, and I started going into making that list after 6 and 7 and because I already had it, and making that amends. Amends, you guys, ninth step is so crucial. I can't impress upon that like more because you think the work is done after 4 and 5. It's not. 6 and 7, I'm constantly asking God to remove my character defects and help me, right? 6 and 7 will be a forever thing for me. But 8 and 9, I'm like, how am I going to do this? I already admitted, like, my part in these resentments. How am I going to go to these people? And people that have cut me off, right? And so I did it because I was willing to go to any lengths. My sponsor said, come on, do you want to do this or not? And I wasn't going to waste your time. I said, okay. So I made all my cards. I started making those amends. But what happened with my amends in ninth step, I was about 3 years sober. Was it 3 years sober when Dad got cancer? I got a call from my dad, and Scott and I were in Vegas, and he said, I've been diagnosed with cancer. I have 2 to 6 months to live. And I said, I need to go down there and I need to make this amends to this man that I hated so much, even though he was able to help me out with treatment, right? And I believed in God. I had a God of my own understanding then, but like something happened that day when I was able to sit with this man who was dying, who all I ever wanted was that unconditional love from, but knowing he suffered for like the same way I suffered. He was an alcoholic and an addict. I understood that. I had a different outlook on life because I had a psychic change as a result of these steps, right? And so what happened was, is I was able to sit and own up to my stuff and ask him how I could make things right. And that day, God came through to me like no other. And I never thought that would be a thing. And I'm like, okay, this is what we need to do. That man didn't last very long afterwards. And I was able, because of you guys, showed me how to be a daughter here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys have shown me how to be a friend, a wife, a sister, all the things, right? And I was able to drive down because I was working in hospice at the time. And God puts me in places, and it's really weird. You know, like, I was working in treatment for a while, and then I'm like, this isn't vibing with me because we're not supposed to get paid to take people through the steps, right? And so I had to leave, and God placed something in my life, and I didn't know he was preparing me for what I was about to go through with my dad. And I was able to go down to the VA hospital and sit with him the day before he passed because, again, I don't know how to stay sober through any kind of emotional situations, you guys, right? And this was on my fears list. Like, if my parents die, anything like that, I'm going to get loaded. But instead, I had some women that had lost their parents in this program that had carried me through. And they told me what to do. And he could barely talk, you know, but I got to feed him a milkshake, bring him a milkshake, sit with him, and, you know, put socks on his feet and just be there. You know what I mean? And it was the most amazing amends that I could have ever done because I fulfilled a living amends to that man. And I don't ever finish anything, you guys. That's just not what I'm used to. So, you know, I made those amends, and I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous and the women in these rooms and some of my brothers, too, for always being there for me. You know, 10, 11, and 12 are our maintenance steps, and I can't impress upon that even more, too, because 10, 11, and 12 save my ass every single day and throughout the day. I don't do it perfectly, but I need to spot check when something's not feeling right in here, you know? Because when something's not right in here, I'm not connected to my higher power, my God. And I love sponsorship. I absolutely love sponsorship and what it has brought to my life because I get to take women through the book and I get to show them what was given to me and how I got here. If you want what I have, you have to do what I do. And that's what was told to me when I was new. And that's what I've been doing for the past 10 years is taking women through the work, doing the best of my ability like no other. I don't do it perfectly. I got a divorce from that man that I told you guys about. Oh, thank you, God. And I didn't get loaded, right? I have gotten jobs. I have lost jobs. And I haven't gotten loaded. Why? Because I have a God of my own understanding. I've met my best friend here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I absolutely love him with all my heart because he's my rock. You know, I never had that before, but I had to love myself before I could love anybody else. I would love to have my little victims, you know what I mean, and my early sobriety and my hostages. But I had to look within myself to get to where I was. Water seeks its own level, as somebody told me once. And I got to meet my best friend here, and I got to marry Scott, you know, 4 years ago. And a month after we got married, we had some tragic stuff happen in my family. My aunt tragically died, and we got to be a service to my family, you know. I'm trusted today by my family. That brother of mine that 86'd me from his life, we have the same birthday. I would reach out to him every year on my sober birthday and try to just, you know, hey, you know, this is what I'm doing. I hope you're doing well. Happy birthday. And he would say, F you, you know. I saw him for the first time at 5 years sober, or no, 4 years sober when my dad died. And I tried to do the amends as possible, like what I could do. And God knew I wasn't ready for that relationship. God knew I would cause more damage, you know what I mean? So I had to wait another 5 more years for my brother to be ready. And so last year, my grandparents were on their deathbeds, and what happened was is I was driving down on New Year's Eve to San Diego because I don't know if I'm ever going to see my grandparents again. And I'm like, God, I know it's a possibility I'm going to see my brother. it's okay. I'm not going to push it anymore. He needs to do what he needs to do. It's your will, not mine. And as I've stayed here longer, each year my God has had to get bigger. It's not the same God that I had when I first got sober. It wasn't sufficient enough to keep me sober, the same God 10 years ago that it is now today. And I saw my brother for the first time New Year's Eve of 2024? Yeah, 24. No, 25? 24. 24. I don't know. And that's where things changed. And God said, okay, here you go, kid. And I was able to make amends to that man a little over a year ago. And that same night I made amends to him, I got to meet my nieces and nephews. The things that I wanted to get sober for that I couldn't, because frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Nobody's going to get me sober but my willingness and my desperation, right? And they're great motivation. Like, the kids are great motivation, but they're not going to keep me sober. And so I finally got to meet my nieces and nephews a little over a year ago. And they ran up to me and just, Auntie Shelby, I've been praying for that my whole entire sobriety. But I gave up on it because it was God's will, not mine, you know? And I couldn't do that because I could not hold on to that, because it wasn't in my cards at the time. If I just surrender, just like I did when I got sober, God's going to protect me. God's going to take me wherever I need to go, right? God's going to place whoever's supposed to be in my path, and I firmly believe that. And where I'm at today is Alcoholics Anonymous has to be my number one priority. It's been kind of rough the past 6 months, you know? Staying longer does not mean it gets easier. I swear to God. I thought you guys all had it together with, like, double digits and, like, they're doing it so effortlessly and making it look so seamless, right? When I was like a year or two sober. And then somebody said, get some time and find out. And I'm really grateful for them saying that, you know, because it doesn't get easier. I have to work harder at my sobriety and my recovery than I did 5 years ago and 10 years ago. You know what I mean? When I was a newcomer, I was on fire for this baby. But I have to find that new love for Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm going to need you guys one day. I need you guys every single day. And I just don't know it. That's why Mark reaching out to me on Wednesday, I went through some stuff, and, you know, 5 minutes after I get home, he hits me up, and God's like, here you go, kid. Don't forget me, because I got you. You need to be with your people, because we're going to keep you, and we're going to raise you up, and we're going to be okay, you know? And I'm never going to say no. I mean, I do, but not right now. Where I'm at right now spiritually, I'm not going to say no. I'm going to show up to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to go to a Nooner meeting. I'm going to say yes no matter what anybody asks me to do right now, because like 6 months ago I was saying no. But where I'm at today is I'm going to put Alcoholics Anonymous front forth, because that's what I think God wants me to do. So if you're new in here, I welcome you. If you're struggling, you don't have to live this way anymore, dude. You just don't. Life is so much better. It's not rainbows and butterflies and all the things, but it's hell of a lot better than getting loaded and wanting to die every morning. So thank you for letting me share. Thank you.